little Sanyutta. This is part of the Sanyutta Nikaya, the connected discourses of the Buddha, and they're all about the extent, the idea of samsara. Samsara being the round of birth and death, right? These suttas are like descriptions of samsara, what it is like. And of course, this is a very important part of what we call right view in Buddhism. The idea that we have rebirth, we have karma, that actually is the mechanism behind that, and all of these things. They are, as we have seen before, this is what we call vijja, true knowledge, real insight on the Buddhist path, the idea of these things. So for that reason, it's interesting. But actually, it's quite simple at the same time. It's just having seeing how this works. So, this particular sutta is called Tears, and it's all about rebirth. So, at Savati, because this samsara is without discoverable beginning, the first point is not discerned of beings roaming and wandering on, hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving. And you will probably notice this straight away. This is very similar to the beginning of the sutta we had looked at the other day, where it says that there is no beginning to ignorance, right? Or there's no discoverable beginning to ignorance. And of course, the idea here is that ignorance and samsara are very closely related to each other. Samsara goes on precisely because of ignorance. So these two are very related concepts. So as I was saying that at that time, is one of these very interesting ideas in the Buddhist teaching that there is no first point, right? This is one of the things that makes the Buddhist teachings so different from all other kind of philosophy and religion, even different from science itself. Science posits the beginning with the Big Bang, but from Buddhism, there is no first point. And this is one of those teachings that I find so sensible from a Buddhist point of view. And then it has this nicely, I'm not going to go any more into that because we've spoken about this already, but then it says this nice little thing, a first point is not discerned of beings roaming and wandering on, right? This idea of roaming and wandering on. Roaming is like this English word, which means like this you kind of random movement. You're not really going anywhere in particular. There's no destination. Just going here, now going there, kind of roaming around without any kind of final point we're actually heading towards. And this is the problem with samsara. We're not actually going anywhere. We're wandering this way, wandering that way, going up, going down, going across wiser. But actually, there's no destination in this. It's just the same thing repeated again and again and again. Slight variations of the theme, right? One lifetime you're reborn in India, so you eat Indian food. Another time you're reborn in Norway and you eat Norwegian food, or you're reborn in Malaysia and you eat a bit of Chinese food and a bit of Malay food, you know? That is really the kind of the how interesting samsara is. That's kind of the differences. Slight variations on the theme as we wonder about. And this is what actually one of the great Ajahns in Thailand once said. This was Ajahn Tate. And he said that, you know, what's the big deal about traveling around in the world and seeing this and seeing that? I know you have just been to Japan, right? Did many of you go to the trip to Japan? Many here? Yes? Okay. Right. So I don't want to take away the fun. Of course, when you go on a pilgrimage to a place like Japan, it is not just for sightseeing, it's also for Buddhist input as well, so it is actually much more wholesome in many ways. But a lot of the tourist thing that people do around in the world is just to see a little bit extra, see a little bit here, see a little bit there. And Ajahn Tate said, what's the point? All you do is just variations on the same theme, just entertainment, right? So instead of going, as Ajahn Brahm always likes to say, instead of traveling to see the Great Wall of China, just go to the entrance gate of the monastery and have a look at the monastery wall, right? This is kind of a killjoy, really kind of destroying the fun of travel. Anyway, that is kind of very kind of monastic way of looking at, Ajahn Brahm way of looking at things. Most people would not agree with that. So, but anyways, this idea of roaming on, wandering on aimlessly, not actually going anywhere, not having any final goal, hindered by ignorance. My friend Ajahn Sujato, he recently wrote a little article. There is a a nice, you know, he is, I don't know if you know, but he is kind of running this website called Sutta Central, where all the suttas are found in, ideally both the Chinese one, the ones in Chinese translation, the one in Pali, the ones in Sanskrit, also with translations into all modern languages, right? There too, there is a discussion platform, and he kind of, sometimes he discusses various points on the suttas. And he made the point that the idea of hindrance, right, the five hindrances, sometimes the better translation for that word might be a trap, right? And so here you can have wandering on, trapped by ignorance. Of course, these are similar kind of feelings in the word, but it's quite nice when you hear trapped by ignorance. There's a sense that you cannot find any way out. You are in the darkness. You don't know the escape, right? You need some external input like the Buddha to kind of pull you out. Otherwise, you are actually literally trapped by ignorance. So ignorance is what is a self-perpetuating force that does not allow us to find a way out. And fettered by craving. Craving is what ties us again to the round, right? It is the thing that keeps the momentum going in the forward cycle of rebirth. Craving is the thing that propels you forward, projects you into a new existence. And only without that does existence actually come to a stop. So a very nice little beginning of the sutta, very meaningful, all of this. These are the kind of things that are nice to reflect on a little bit. Anyway, now we come to the kind of main meat of the sutta. What do you think, bhikkhus, which is more, the stream of tears that you have shed as you roamed and wandered on through this long course, weeping and wailing because of being united with the disagreeable and separated from the agreeable, this or the water in the four great oceans? Right? So this again, the point of this, right? We see our present life, and that is all we are really aware of for the vast majority of people. The very few people have a real feeling of the past as it stretches back almost indefinitely into the past, and potentially with the future as well, stretching into the future. Because all we see is our present life. Yes, our present life, there is some degree of suffering. Everybody has plenty of suffering in their lives. But it is as nothing when you compare it to the real reality of the big picture view of seeing samsara in its entirety. And this is what the Buddha is pointing out here. And this is why it is so important to have somebody seeing this. Because without the Buddha pointing these things out to us, there's absolutely no way that we are aware of this enormous problem, right? You have shed more tears than there is water in the four oceans. It's a lot of water, many tears, right? What a tear is very, very tiny. The water in the four, how many tears is that? You can make a calculation how many tears it takes to fill up the whole ocean. I don't know how many tears it is, but we're talking about many, many zeros behind the one, right? I don't know how many zeros, a lot of zeros. This is kind of the point. It is a beginningless thing. There is no first point that is discerned, and that is part of the problem there. So for this reason, the Buddha kind of draws these things out, and it's because it is so hard to see these things otherwise. So it's quite stark, right? It's kind of scary when you read this, but it might just be true, and that is why it is useful to listen to these things when the Buddha says these things. The water of the four oceans, of course, the idea of the four great oceans, that is an idea that they had at the time of the Buddha, doesn't really correspond to the modern idea of the world. It probably corresponds to the oceans that went around India, but that's enough water, right? It doesn't have to be all the oceans of the world. It's enough to have the oceans going around India. So that sort of still makes the same point pretty much. Okay, And then the monks answer, as we understand the Dhamma taught by the Blessed One, Venerable Sir, the stream of tears that we have shed as we roamed and wandered through this long course, weeping and wailing because of being united with the disagreeable and separated from the agreeable, this alone is more than the water in the four great oceans. Good, good, bhikkhus, it is good that you understand the Dhamma taught by me in such a way, because indeed the stream of tears that you have shed as you roamed and wandered through this long course, weeping and wailing because of being united with the disagreeable and separated from the agreeable, this alone is more than the water in the four great oceans. For a long time, bhikkhus, you have experienced the death of a mother, as you have experienced this weeping and wailing because of being united with the disagreeable, separated from the agreeable. The streams that you have shed, the stream of tears is more than the water in the four great oceans. How many mothers have we lost through this long samsara? Every time you lose your mother dies. It has happened millions, perhaps billions of times before, and every time it is equally painful and difficult. And after a while, you get fed up with that, and you want to get out of it. For a long time, bhikkhus, you have experienced the death of a father, the death of a brother, the death of a sister, the death of a son, the death of a daughter. Right, often when your children die before you, it feels like something has gone wrong in the world because the parents are supposed to die first and the children afterwards. But sometimes life is not fair like that. Life is unfair precisely because of the complexities of karma, the complexities of causes and conditions. Often the son and the daughter die first, and then of course the parents are distraught as a consequence of that. So don't think that the dying of a young child is somehow against nature. That too is part of how nature works. It's a beautiful simile. I don't know if this is the right, maybe I can bring out that simile now. The simile that Ajahn Brahm usually teaches about the naturalness of children dying, right? And why sometimes children die, sometimes middle-aged people, usually the old people die first. That is a simile. He tells the story of a monk who was living in the north of Thailand somewhere. And he was living in this little kuti, this little hut in the forest that was made just of grass. Very simple hut, right? But enough for meditation, enough for living the life of a hermit, if you like. But he was living in the middle of the jungle. And in the middle of the jungle, there's lots of large trees around, right? There's, like you see the trees here in Malaysia, because it's the tropics, often they are incredibly large, very heavy trees. And one night, as he was meditating, the storm was growing, right? This enormous storm was coming through. And as the storm got worse and worse and worse, the trees, the branches, everything started to come tumbling down. Sometimes large trees falling over, enormous branches being torn off the trees and falling to the ground. And he thought that he might die that night. If one of those trees or branches hit his little grass hut, he would have been annihilated. It would have been the end of him. And then in the morning, he's kind of happy that he's still alive, right? That's one that was kind of good enough in a sense. But then he comes out of his hut and he looks around. And when he looks around, because of the strong wind, he sees all the leaves that have been torn off the trees. There is leaves everywhere on the ground, right? And when he sees those leaves on the ground, most of those leaves are the old leaves that have fallen to the ground. The brown ones, the yellow ones, the ones that were about to fall off the tree anyway. But in between, he sees leaves that are mature, right? Leaves that are at the kind of the height of their life, mature green leaves. And occasionally, in between all those leaves, he sees a tiny little leaves, the young ones, the green, the ones that have just sprouted, which they still have a very light green color. they too sometimes have been torn off the tree because of the power of that wind. And then he looks up into the trees and he looks at the leaves that are remaining on the branches. And of course the majority of the leaves that are remaining on the branches are the young ones and the middle-aged ones, the green ones and the ones that have recently sprouted. But occasionally in between all of those leaves, he still sees a few brown ones clinging on, right, grasping onto the tree. They have refused to come off despite of the strong winds. Sometimes life is a bit like that. And then he realizes that this is the nature of existence. For human beings, it's exactly the same. Most of the time, it is the old people who die, who fall away, who come off the tree. But sometimes also the middle-aged people have to die because of whatever accidents or illnesses. And very occasionally, even little babies and young children have to die. It is according to nature, just as it is according to the nature, that the leaves fall off the tree in this way, in a kind of not a stable way, but in a kind of random way, in this way. And then, of course, it is also the same thing with people surviving, right? Sometimes the old people hang on, they cling on till they are 90, 95, 100, right? Become really, really old. And that's wonderful when people do that, especially if they can have a meaningful life when they get very old. It's a great thing. But then in the meantime, their children might die, their grandchildren might even die, right? While they are still hanging on. And this is the nature of life, just as it is the nature of the leaves to fall off the tree in this way. It's a nice simile to drive home the point that nature is like this. Nothing has gone wrong just because people die at different times. Okay, so you have been crying and wailing, right, because of a death of a son, the death of a daughter, the loss of relatives, the loss of wealth, right? And as people commit suicide when they lose all their wealth, you hear people jumping off tall buildings and that kind of stuff when you have financial crisis and that sort of thing. The loss through illness, as you have experienced this, weeping and wailing because of being united with the disagreeable and separated from the agreeable, the stream of tears that you have shed is more than the water in the four great oceans. For what reasons? Because this samsara is without discoverable beginning. Right? The first point is not discerned of beings roaming and wandering on, hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving. It is enough to experience revulsion towards all formations, enough to become dispassionate towards them, enough to be liberated from them. Right, when you see this, and this is kind of the point here, when you see the scope of samsara, what it is really like, when you see the true nature of suffering, and this is what this is really about, this is an insight into suffering. Sometimes we think insight is some kind of very special thing when you sit down in meditation and you see things arising and passing away, but often insight is something like this, which is much more immediately understandable, the idea of rebirth and death and all the sorrow that comes along with this. This is also insight, right? But insight of a slightly different nature from seeing things arising and passing away. So this is also very, very interesting because it changes your view of reality to such an extent that you experience nibbida, revulsion, repulsion, aversion, right? A very strong emotional response to all formations. This means all conditioned phenomena, everything in the world. The five khandhas is what is meant by this. All your experiences are included in that, right? And this is why it is so incredibly profound, because it includes basically everything. And when you, of course, and when you have this experience of being repelled by everything, it's very hard to understand. I don't really expect anyone to really be able to take this on board fully, because it is very hard, but at least you have some idea what the Buddha is talking about. Of course, when you do that, you lose your attachment and desire for these things. And this is the idea of becoming dispassionate, viraga. The craving is fading away, right? The fading away of all these things. And then, when craving finally fades away for the last time, this is the idea of being liberated. You're liberated because you are no longer attached to what? To suffering, right? All of this is suffering, the things that you are attached to. So you are liberated. This is liberation in Buddhism. Liberation means precisely the non-attachment, the non-craving for things that are a problem, things that are suffering in your life. So, there you are, right? This is right view. It's quite challenging. It's quite kind of, whoa. And this is when people think, kind of start to wonder whether they really are Buddhists after all, you know? And it's different if you have grown up as a Buddhist, and it's kind of different because it's sort of, it's part of almost everything you have learned, so you almost have a kind of view of these things together. But many people in the Western world, right, they think, oh, Buddhism is so nice, you are compassionate and kind, right? And then this kind of thing comes into your face, and think, whoa, maybe I'm not so sure anymore if I really was a Buddhist in the first place. Actually, usually people do persevere, but they have sometimes to go through these kind of periods when they have a bit of uncertainty, but then they kind of come back on the path again, right? And this is kind of one of the important things about any kind of really profound teaching, is that it should be challenging to some extent, right? It should challenge you. If it doesn't challenge you at all, you may wonder, what's the point of these teachings? It should be something that really drives you towards something positive. Otherwise, you're just dealing with the same old habits, the same old personal character traits that you have already. So sometimes we need to be challenged to move ourselves on out of those habits, to move towards something more wholesome, something better in our lives. So don't be afraid of challenges, right? Challenges are often, in the longer term, they often have a positive effect if you use them wisely and you don't allow them to depress you or make you sad or anything like that. So be wise about how you use these things. Remember, the purpose of the Buddhist teaching is to make you more happy, more content. So don't allow these things to detract from that happiness. Anyway, so that is the first sutta on tears. I will now read a couple of more which are roughly on the same theme, just to really hammer home the point. Okay, and if you're not depressed at the end of this, it means that you are really on the right track and you're doing very well. So this next one is called Unfortunate, right? On one occasion, while dwelling at Savatthi, the Blessed One said this: because this samsara is without discoverable beginning, the first point is not seen of beings roaming and wandering on, hindered by ignorance or trapped by ignorance, and fettered. Fettered means like tied, and tied by craving. Whenever you see anyone in misfortune, in misery, you can conclude, we too, or I too, have experienced the same thing in this long course. For what reason? Because this samsara is without discoverable beginning. The first point is not discerned of beings roaming and wandering on, hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving. It is enough to experience revulsion towards all conditioned phenomena, enough to become dispassionate towards them, enough to be liberated from them. Right? It's kind of nice to remember that. Sometimes we look at the world and we think, oh yeah, I'm really lucky because, you know, I'm not suffering as much as these people over there. I don't live in Afghanistan or in Syria and I'm not being bombed by all these bombs and all of this kind of stuff. But actually, we have already been there. We've already been through that already. And you probably will go there again. So the difference between us and them is really zero. There is no difference. And it also shows you that we should never really look down upon anyone. We should never look down on somebody as seeing them as some kind of miserable, poor person which is uneducated and stupid, right? We have also been stupid at one stage. We have also been uneducated at one stage. We have been there too. And once you think like that, you can have compassion for these people without feeling proud of your own kind of better situation in life, because you too have been there. So in a sense, you can recognize yourself when you see those people in difficult situations like that. Right? And not just is it about other people around the world, sometimes it's also about animals. right? We have also sometime in the past, very likely we have also, we must have at some stage, been reborn as animals, right? So when you see animals, remember that could be you again in the future, or certainly it would have been you somewhere in the past. And when you do that again, you have more sense of compassion. You can recognize yourself in there, right? I too am part of this kind of experience. This is part and parcel of what it means to be in this samsaric existence of birth and death. These are the unavoidable things. So it changes your outlook when you see yourself in that situation. If you kind of feel a sense of disgust for some kind of wretched animal in a difficult situation, you are really feeling a sense of disgust for yourself, right? Because you too, that condition is already inside of you, waiting to come forth once the conditions are right. So very important to remember that. It's also true for old age and death and all of these kind of things. All of these things are already inside of us, right? Any culture, any part of humanity, all of those things are inside of us. So it's always important to remember that, because then you don't feel a sense of superiority or difference. We are all kind of in this boat together, in a sense. And that is a very beautiful and nice way of looking at life, humanity, animals, and everyone else for that matter. Okay, let's have a look at the last one. This is the stick. Atsavati, because this samsara is without discoverable beginning. The first point is not discerned of beings roaming and wandering on, hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving. Just as a stick thrown up into the air falls now on its bottom, now on its side, now on its top, so too as beings roam and wander on, hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving, now they go from this world to the other world, now they come from the other world to this world. For what reason? Because this samsara is without discoverable beginning. The first point is not discerned of beings roaming and wandering on, hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving. It is enough to experience revulsion towards all conditioned phenomena, enough to become dispassionate towards them, enough to be liberated from them. Yeah, so this idea that the stick falls on different sides. You don't rebirth. Now you get reborn in the lower realm, now in the higher realm. Now you come back to humanity, right? And these things are so uncertain. And in the long run, because of non-self, because we are the function of the cause and conditions that work on us, it means we don't really know where we're going to be reborn in the future. Maybe in this life we have more, we are kind of doing things in the right way, we become Buddhist, we practice well, and the chances of a good rebirth are very high. But you don't know what's going to happen in your next life. You don't know what's going to happen in the long run. And in the long run, over the long course of samsara, you are a bit like this yo-yo I was talking about yesterday, right? This yo-yo going up and down, not really uncertain what is going to happen next time around. So this is the idea of the stick. It doesn't mean that karma doesn't work. Karma, of course, works. It just means that the doing, the making of karma depends on causal conditions. And because of that, in the long run, you don't really have control over that. It feels like we have control of our karma. It feels like we know what we are doing. It feels like I'm in charge. I will make good karma. I will not make bad karma. But in the long run, you don't have control. And this is what non-self is all about, right? Things happen according to cause and conditions. It's very hard to see this because it feels like we are in control. And that, of course, is a very important part of the delusion of self, right? That we feel like we are in control. But actually, the Buddha here is saying, no, we go up and down, like a stick falling on the ground. So, are you depressed now? Are you okay? Can't deal with this? Okay, well, I'm very glad you can deal with these things. So it's not, the purpose is not to make you depressed or unhappy or miserable or sad. Please do not commit suicide because of this, right? It's not going to be very helpful anyway. Take it more as something, okay, I will think about this and then see if that does help you on your path. That is the most important thing here. So now we have had a little bit of a look at the idea, some of the aspects of right view, and now I want to get back to more practical things again, which are about how to practice this path, and I want to look more in detail about morality itself. The next sutta, just move on to the next page, page 18. This is called Roots, this particular sutta. And this provides the framework, the background through which morality and ethics is supposed to be understood on the Buddhist path. So often very useful to have these kind of suttas that give background information, because it gives us the big picture before we move on to the details. Okay, so the word for roots in Pali is mula. Mula means root, just like in English, it means the root of a tree, but it also means root in the sense of the base of something, the foundation of something. Like in English, we use the root in exactly the same way. The root cause, right? The root of something is the basis of something else. And these roots, they are then, in this case, they mean the root of action, the thing which is at the base, the foundation of the actions we do, and then that drive our action forwards. One of the great ways of translating this word, in my opinion, is motivation. Right? What is it that motivates us in our action? What is it that drives us to act? This is called motivation in English. In English, you have the two difference between two words that are used a lot in the suttas that is quite handy to think of when you think about action and karma and these kind of things. And that is the distinction between motivation on the one hand and intention on the other hand. Motivation is the thing that makes you do something, right? I am motivated to act because I feel compassion. So you are motivated by compassion. Intention is what you are aiming to do. I intend to be kind. I intend to help somebody, right? That is your intention. It's actually what you are aiming for, is the purpose of your action. So motivation is where you're coming from. You're coming from compassion, and your aim is to be helpful and kind. Intention and motivation, two sides of two very important aspects of the idea of karma. So please keep those things in mind, because they will become useful when we look at karma in this kind of perspective. Okay, so this is what the Buddha has to say about this. Because there are these three unwholesome roots, akusala mula, or you can say unskillful roots perhaps. What three? The unwholesome root of greed. This is loba, this is like desire, right? Very, almost like a synonym for craving, if you like. The unwholesome root of hatred. This is dosa. And hatred is a very strong word. I would prefer to use something like ill will or anger there, because hate is a very powerful emotion. And it means really all kinds of negativity towards other. Ill will, I think, is preferable. And the last one, the unwholesome root of delusion. This is moha in Pali here. And usually the way that delusion, I use delusion in the suttas, is as a translation of avidya. Avidya, again, remember, is this word which means not seeing things according to reality, not having insight, being blinded, seeing a self where there is no self, seeing permanence where there is impermanence, and these kind of things. So I prefer to use the word delusion for the very kind of foundational misunderstanding of the nature of reality. But here we're talking about moha, and moha is one of the factors that are the unwholesome motivations that drive unwholesome actions. And as such, it doesn't just refer to the most deep-seated delusion, it also refers to ordinary delusion in ordinary life, like being confused, like being restless, like being slothful, right? All of these things are slightly deluded states of mind, where you're lacking clarity, you don't see things properly. So I like to call this instead confusion, I think is for me, perhaps a slightly better way of translating this. The unwholesome root of confusion, I quite like. So what we have here then, we have these three unwholesome motivations. Desire, like sensual desire, craving, ill will, and confusion, right? Three unwholesome motivations, three things that if you go by them, if you allow those things to drive you, to make you act, then you are in trouble. So in what sense are these things motivations? And one way of looking at this is to know that if you desire something, that desire tends to compel you to act. Desire says, act now, you need this, you must have it, right? Now is the time, go for it. Okay, that food looks really nice, go for that food, right? You've got to have that one. Again, that's kind of fairly innocent, and much obviously far, far worse things than that, but that gives you the idea of how compelling these things are. They drive you, they make you do things, and that's why they're called motivations. Ill will is a similar kind of thing, right? Now, act. Tell that person off. Right, they have been bad. Yeah, you're right. I've got to tell this person off. Right, so ill will is again this compelling force inside of you that drives you forward and makes you act. And confusion can be the same thing. You don't really understand what is happening. You're confused about the situation. You don't really know what to do. Okay, I better act. But actually, maybe you were completely wrong about that. So these are these strong forces, not always strong, sometimes they can be weak as well, but they are the forces inside of us that make us act. And this is what the Buddha has to say then as we move on. So he says, whatever desire, craving, greed occurs, bhikkhus, it is unwholesome, right? Whatever type of greed occurs, it is always unwholesome, always unskillful, always bad. Whatever deed a greedy or desiring or craving person performs by body, speech, and mind, that too is unwholesome. Right? When you do any kind of deed based on greed, by definition, it is unwholesome. It leads to negative things. You feel bad about yourself. And ultimately, if you do enough of this stuff, it also leads to unwholesome or unpleasant consequences in the future life specifically. Yeah. Right? Unwholesome. What does it mean to be greedy by mind? Because action performed by the mind. And what this means is usually very powerful tendencies in the mind. And in the sutta, this is specifically defined as when you want the belongings of others, right? Or may those belongings of others become mine, right? I want those as well. It's kind of jealousy and envy and powerful, strong greed for other people's possessions. And this is the kind of unwholesome mind state. It has to be quite strong for it to really be unwholesome mind states, but there's a kind of mind state that tends to drive you and make you act later on that mind state. Little mind states, like a little bit of desire here and there, is not really a big deal, right? Because everybody has that every now and again, but these very strong impulses is really the problem. When a greedy person, overcome by greed, with mind obsessed by it, inflicts suffering upon another under a false pretext, it says here, but whatever it is, by killing, imprisonment, confiscation, in other words, by stealing or taking, by censure or, you know, by criticizing or by banishment, thinking, I am powerful, I want power, that too is unwholesome. Thus, the numerous bad, unwholesome qualities originate in him, born of greed, caused by greed, arisen from greed, conditioned by greed. So here, the idea with all of this is simply to point out that when you are greedy, you end up doing bad things, right? Your mind being overcome by greed, you end up inflicting suffering on other people. This is what greed does. You steal things. You may even kill them. You may talk badly to them. This is what this is really all about. It's all about the ways that we inflict problems on other people because of our greed. Yeah, and one of those thinking there, of course, is in part that it says here, I am powerful. The idea that we are empowered, that we have this mastery, we can control our situation, and we think that we can control things. That is why we end up doing bad things. We actually think that we are creating happiness for ourselves by using our power to gain things for ourselves that are not really ours, and then causing suffering for other people as we do that. And this is it's a very delusive state of mind, this idea that we are powerful, that we can do these kind of things, because we think that we're creating happiness for ourselves, when in fact, you don't really have any power at all. What you are really doing here in the long run is creating suffering for yourself instead. You have the power to create suffering for yourself, right? But that power that you feel then will not create happiness for yourself at all. And it's this, so be careful, this doer inside of us, this agent, the sense of being powerful, the sense of being in charge, the sense of being able to create our own happiness, even through the unwholesome, is a very deluded state of mind. It was quite interesting, I was reading an article recently. Sometimes I read a little bit in newspapers and that sort of thing. And this was an article about some research that had been done on what happens to people when they actually do gain things in an unrighteous way. They steal something, or they rip somebody off, or they get something by exploiting somebody or something like that. And what was very interesting about this article was that they had shown that people who gained wealth in an unwholesome way, they were not really able to enjoy that wealth in the same way. The happiness wasn't there anymore. But if you work hard and you gain money, or you gain your wealth in an honest way, by honest work, all these kind of things, then you're actually able to enjoy that wealth. Right? It's very interesting, because this is exactly what the Buddha says in the suttas. It's always nice when kind of the modern research matches with what it says in the sutta. The Buddha says exactly that. He says that elsewhere, that you know, you work hard, you know, with the wealth that you have earned by the sweat of your brow, by the strength of your arm, righteous wealth, righteously gained. You use that wealth for making yourself happy, for making your parents happy, making your family happy, making your relatives happy, making everyone happy. That is the wealth you use to donate to charitable causes, right? And all of these kind of things. Why? Because that wealth really feels like it is yours. You deserve that. And when you give that away, it really feels like an act of generosity. If it really belongs to you, then it really is an act of generosity. If it didn't really belong to you in the first place, it doesn't feel like an act of generosity in the same way. Right? So very interesting how you can see here this idea of this actually now has been shown also by experiment that this actually is quite true, that the Buddha is talking in this way. So important, so much more useful to earn things in the right way rather than getting things in an unrighteous way and then not really being able to enjoy it as a consequence. So this is part of the problem of all of this. So not only don't you enjoy that wealth, you also create bad karma. It's a lose-lose situation, right? Let's get into the win-win rather than the lose-lose. Win-win is just much better than lose-lose. So let's get into the win-win situation. Win-win means you do things in the right way, and then you can use it and spend it in the right way as well. Thus, the numerous bad, unwholesome qualities originate in him, born of desire, caused by desire, arisen from craving, conditioned by greed. So all of these things, whenever we do something bad, it is always conditioned by these unwholesome roots, right? And this is a very important message here, because this here is really the core of the Buddhist teaching of ethics and morality, that what is unethical in the world is always those things that are motivated by the unwholesome roots. Anything unethical is motivated by the unwholesome roots. And the opposite is true. Anything that is ethical is always motivated by the wholesome roots, right? By the non-greed, in other words, by generosity. By non-hatred, in other words, by metta and kindness. By non-delusion or non-confusion, in other words, by clarity of mind and insight. And this is so important, because sometimes when we are taught about morality, we are taught about precepts, and precepts are of course very important and very significant, but they are not the end of the story. It is not the final explanation of what ethics is all about. This here is the final explanation. So what that means, for example, if you do occasionally maybe break a precept even, then the important thing is where you are coming from. Why are you breaking this precept? Are you breaking it because of one of these unwholesome roots? If you are, you know it is unethical, you know it is bad. But if in certain circumstances, right, this is very rare and unusual, but if in certain circumstances, say, that you were able to break a precept, but you did it because of the wholesome roots, because of compassion, because of kindness, then this, what the Buddha is saying here, means that in that situation, it is not bad karma. You haven't done anything unethical. Right? And this, what this does, it opens up the idea of Buddhist ethics in a way that almost no other ethical system does. Because it allows us to fine-tune ethics. It allows us to see what karma is really, really bad because it comes from very unwholesome motivation and conduct. And it allows us to see karma, which is somewhere in between, which is not really very, very unwholesome, nor very, very bad. The motivation is not very bad, nor very good. And then the karma, that is very good. It opens up an entirely different way of understanding karma and understanding ethics. And this is one of the beautiful ways of beautiful things about the Buddhist teachings. It has this very flexible ethical system which allows it to be used for modern dilemmas of all kind, right? These days, For example, in Australia, a lot of talk about things like euthanasia and assisted suicide, and often we talk about dilemmas like stem cell research and abortion and all of these kind of things. And when you do that, the Buddhist framework allows you a very rounded, a very comprehensive view of all of these ethical dilemmas. It's not black and white anymore. It is grayish. There's all kind of variations on the theme, all depending on one factor, the motivation, where you're coming from when you're doing these things. Yeah, and this is the importance of this sutta. It allows ethics to become much more reasonable, much more rational. It is based on a very solid foundation in this way here. This is why I like to read this one out. I normally talk about these things, but I also like to point back to the source of these teachings in the suttas. And because we have so many hours on this retreat, I thought this is our chance to look at these things in a bit more detail. Okay, now comes a very similar kind of thing, a very similar kind of paragraph, but now with the other types of bad motivation. Whatever anger occurs is unwholesome. Whatever deed a person full of anger performs by body, speech, and mind is also unwholesome. When a person full of anger, overcome by anger, with a mind obsessed by it, inflicts suffering upon another under a false pretext, like before, by killing, imprisonment, confiscation, censure or banishment, thinking, I am powerful, I want power, that too is unwholesome. The numerous bad, unwholesome qualities originate in him, born of anger, caused by anger, arisen from anger, conditioned by anger. The same idea again. Anger is one of these motivation driving forces that make you do all of these bad things. Anger performs deeds by body, speech, and mind. And to perform a deed by mind that is unwholesome because of anger, again, it means a very serious degree of anger in the mind, right? Like, may these beings perish, may these beings die, I hate these beings, right? That kind of idea. It's a very strong kind of hatred inside of you. Then, if you have that, then it's enough that you think them for it to be unwholesome. And we have the last one. Whatever confusion occurs is unwholesome. Whatever action a confused person performs by body, speech, and mind is also unwholesome. when a confused or deluded person, overcome by confusion and delusion, with a mind obsessed by it, inflicts suffering upon another under a false pretext. Just as before, thinking, I am powerful, I want power, that too is unwholesome. Thus, the numerous bad, unwholesome qualities originate in him, born of delusion, caused by delusion, arisen from confusion, conditioned by confusion. So here, it's part of this is wrong view, wrong misunderstanding of the way the world works. You're confused by that, thinking, yeah, when I die, everything is going to be finished anyway, so no worries, I can do a few bad deeds, doesn't matter so much, I won't have to kind of feel the consequences of that, so yeah, so just chill and just, do some few bad things is okay. Yeah. That kind of confusion, that kind of delusion is what is meant by this. And then we have this nice simile, as always, by which the Buddha explained this. Suppose a tree was choked and enveloped by three maluva creepers. Creepers are the things that grow on the outside of the tree, right? The kind of things growing up. It would meet with calamity, with disaster, with calamity and disaster. So the idea here, these maluva creepers, they are kind of the creepers that destroy the tree, strangle the tree eventually, and actually kill it. And this is the problem with these kind of creepers. They're very powerful and destructive forces. That is what meant here with calamity and disaster. This word calamity is very strong. It's almost funny how strong it is, but it kind of gives you the idea what is going on. So too, such a person overcome by bad, unwholesome qualities, born of desire, born of ill will and anger, born of confusion and delusion, with his mind obsessed by them, dwells in suffering in this very life, with distress, anguish and fever, and with the breakup of the body after death, a bad destination can be expected for him. These are the three unwholesome roots. Yeah, so these are the maluva creepers that creep into your mind and strangle you, right? And really make your life so miserable. And as it says here, you dwell in suffering in this very life. If you have a lot of strong desires, right, inside of you, it is very painful because you always try to kind of satisfy these desires. By doing that, you end up doing bad things at the same time. And these are like you're burning inside. It's like a fever and anguish inside of you, driving you forward, never really feeling satisfied. These strong desires are very destructive and very painful forces inside of any kind of being. Anger, similar kind of thing, right? When you are angry again, it's like this feeling, this fever, the burning inside of you. And what is also so bad about anger is that the reason why people are angry in the world is because anger comes from the fact that we see negative things in the world. You see the negative qualities in other people, you see the negative qualities in things in the world, and by always focusing on the negative, that is why we kind of keep that anger up. And of course, if we always focus on the negative in life, it feels terrible, we feel so miserable, we walk around depressed, always seeing kind of things, always complaining, always being miserable. Right, I'm sure you know what I mean when I talk about that. When you feel really like that, whoa, life is so bad. And then it leads to anger as well, and then you do bad things as a consequence. All of these things coming together, life right here is miserable. You do bad stuff, and then you re-arise in a miserable location in the future. Oh, right? Oh, that is so terrible. We've got to do something about this. We've got to do something quickly, otherwise these things will happen. These are the three unwholesome motivations for actions. So there you are. That is enough for now. Let's have a short break and have a cup of tea or whatever. Go to the toilet, and then we'll see you back again at 10:45.